Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the teleclass Safe Needle Devices. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I would like to let you know that we are delighted that you have joined us for this teleclass today. Thank you very much. Last November, Ed Chrisounis was invited to lecture at the International Federation of Infection Control Conference in Malta. He had some interesting things to say, and he impressed his audience very, very much. Among the letters that follow his name, Ed has a CIC certification and has paid his dues in the trenches of hospital infection control. What he has to share with us today comes from that experience and from his other scientific study. Before I turn the floor over to Ed, I would like to note that there will be several brand names mentioned during the course of this teleclass. Unfortunately, it is unavoidable, and it is not to be taken as an endorsement or an advertisement. As you know, Weber Training is entirely independent and does not market or support any particular product or company. I see, too, that Ed has a similar disclaimer on his fourth slide. So to present the teleclass Safe Needle Devices from the beautiful Burlington, Connecticut, I give you Ed Chrisounis. Ed.
Thank you, Paul. Good afternoon, everyone, to all my infection control colleagues from the U.S., from Canada. It was actually my place of birth in Western Ontario. My understanding with Paul, I was chatting with him just a few minutes ago, that we may have some participants from South America as well. So, buona tarde, buenos dias, and eventually there'll be some people from other parts of the world. On my first slide, as you can see, the title of the presentation today is Safe Needle Devices. And if you go to the next slide, the name of my company, in fact, is WNWN International. The WNWN International, in fact, stands for Waste Not, Want Not. Paul is correct that I have spent a significant amount of time in the trenches in healthcare since 1982. My background is a medical technologist. That's what the MTASCP is for some of you that are not familiar with that terminology. I worked at a hospital in Hartford, Connecticut, where I was in the micro lab, but then also moved into the infectious disease department, and eventually ran a small lab there and also was an ICP. I then moved on into the what some people consider the dark world, the dark side of waste management. I got involved in medical waste management. And lo and behold, in being involved in that industry for the past 15 years now, I'm still greatly involved with healthcare. I visit a lot of facilities domestically and internationally, all types of facilities. And obviously, I continue to need to keep abreast of all types of practices, issues, technologies that are out there. So, next slide. And I apologize for my slowness here. This is my first teleconference of this nature, so I'm looking at my screen and saying next slide and wondering, why isn't it moving? I've got to move it. Okay. Well, what are our objectives today? First of all, is a brief history on hypodermic syringes. Obviously, those of you that have been involved for healthcare for a short period of time or a long period of time have seen those wonderful gizmos and gadgets either as a patient or as a provider of healthcare. So I think just a bit of a review on hypodermic syringes. Then we'll move into some discussion on needle stick injuries, which obviously is some of the driving force behind the safe needle devices. And what is a safe needle device? And we'll discuss some examples, some considerations, and some obstacles. One of the things to keep in mind as I go through my presentation, and again, as I mentioned to you before, Paul indicated to me that some of the participants today are from the United States. So clearly, you are in a position where you've been exposed to these regulations. You should be very knowledgeable on these items. And for you, some of this will be a review. Unfortunately, once you go beyond the borders of the United States, the use of safe needle devices takes on a very different challenge. There are many more different obstacles, one of them being economic in nature, so that if you want to think not only what's happening in your backyard, but also on a global perspective, then think about if, in fact, you did not have these regulations from the U.S. Department of Labor as far as OSHA, and you didn't have a large budget, what might be some of the other constraints in consideration? And some of the photos that I'll show you will, in fact, you know, point to those items. Excuse me. Next slide. Again, as Paul mentioned as well, I will be showing various types of products, and this is not an endorsement, but I think to make the point of what are we talking about, I need to show you some examples of some of the devices that are, in fact, out on the market. Next slide. So let's take a look, in fact, at some of the history behind the syringe. If you look on the right side of your page of your handout, or if you're looking at a slide right now, the word syringe is derived from syrinx and syringos, from Greek words for pipe and tube. And if you notice the small syringe that is on your screen there, this dates back a couple of hundred years now. And in fact, believe it or not, eventually what this became used for was by individuals who were opium addicts, in fact. Next slide. I think this will be an interesting slide to take a look at. The opium addicts, in fact, used to carry these small syringes around their necks as a pendant. And one of the issues that, as these addicts, as you can see from this photograph, these individuals would continue to give themselves injections. And all those little marks are all the various injection sites. So, excuse me, this is the final hours of a morphinist. So we've clearly been using syringes and needles for many years, but the actual development of the hypodermic syringe and needle as we know today is a relatively recent phenomenon. Next slide. Really, we have to go to 1954. There actually was an individual by the name of Glenn Murdoch in New Zealand, who in fact developed the disposal hypodermic syringe. You can see these. As a matter of fact, in many cases they were originally an insulin syringe, but he's also developed these syringes for use in veterinary medicine, obviously in healthcare. There's a personal note here. As you can see, I put down DiOrio's restaurant in Waterbury, Connecticut. Now, yes, I live in Burlington, Connecticut, but I in fact grew up in Waterbury. And in doing my research for the presentation that I did present in Malta, which is based upon, it was interesting that there was Sherwood Medical in Waterbury, Connecticut, and two individuals had described or designed a syringe. And at the same time, at Louis Steakhouse in Columbus, Nebraska, individuals from Becton Dickinson also were thinking along the same lines. So really, the plastic syringe as we know it today is a relatively new device in the context of all the other surgical instruments and metal devices and things that are in fact used in healthcare. Next slide. Now, as I mentioned before, when we start looking at the use of syringes in the context of the United States and then beyond the borders, you have to start looking at some of the challenges that are faced by in countries. I've been fortunate enough to do some work in China, in Armenia, been to Europe several times, did extensive work in the Caribbean. And if you can, as you can see from this photograph, there are some good and not so good items here. On one hand, you've got these sharps, in fact, in a plastic container. Now, for those of you, I'm 44 years old, and no, I won't be asking anybody for their age, but when I started working in healthcare in 1981, we in fact used to throw a lot of things into the garbage. That is, a lot of syringes, needles recapped, sometimes not capped. And as some of you obviously know, we've made progressions in the use of sharps containers. Went from cardboard boxes, went to plastic containers, and now we even have reusable sharps containers that are out there. Excuse me. In this particular case in Dominica, they can't afford to buy sharps containers. Yet they realize that there are hazards associated with needles and syringes. So on one hand, this detergent bottle and the bleach bottle left to right, in fact, are used for sharps. Again, there's no marking. There's no labeling. There hasn't really been much training in the use of these, but they are being used. However, as you can see on the nice and fluffy container, it is overflowing. And as we know, that is one of the issues, that's one of the items that we need to be concerned about with needle sticks is obviously overflowing sharps containers. Next slide. In fact, one of the things I did, this is in another hospital in Port in Dominica. If you look inside of this bleach bottle, you'll notice a number of recap syringes. And my immediate reaction isn't, oh my God, they've been recapping needles or that's not a great practice. One of my questions was, well, why were staff recapping? Have these things, in fact, come in contact with blood, or have they been used to, are they from a multi-dose vial, and after the syringe has been used, now the needle is recapped? I'm not a proponent myself personally of ever recapping, but there are other individuals that, in fact, will do it. So when you start looking at, or if you're evaluating practices, and you're going to go out into the field, into your hospital rooms, and see what people are doing, obviously within the sharps containers is very telling. Next slide. Now, there's a tremendous amount of data, in fact, on the Internet related to needle sticks. Where are, in fact, needle stick injuries occurring? Again, the OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, in the United States, developed the bloodborne pathogen standard. In fact, remember, for those of you that were in healthcare in the early 80s, the proposed standard was out for several years, and the final standard came out in 92. And it's had a couple of changes to it, but we here in the United States have been living with this particular standard. And there are other countries as well that have tried to address the protection of healthcare workers as well. So there is a significant amount of data that's out there on the types of devices, where are needle sticks occurring. This is just one from the website that you see, needlestickforum.net. Again, there are websites that are particular to data for the UK, data for Canada, data for the United States. I've seen things from also Italy, France, and Germany in my research. Next slide. This, in fact, is from the South Glasgow University Hospital Trust, carried out between April 1999 and March 2000, and it was a breakdown of needle stick injuries by procedure. And I find interesting, again, the concealed sharps, cleanup, disposal-related. Very interesting because in some cases, you might think that the individuals that are actually getting stuck here could be the housekeeping or cleaning staff. I mean, we know, obviously, nursing personnel, physicians, GPs, medical technologists, phlebotomists are all individuals that are at risk for occupational and percutaneous needle sticks. Excuse me. Next slide. The U.S. EpiNet data, this is actually a wonderful website because this has been around, one, for many years. Deneen Yeager at the University of Virginia has really been overseeing this and has done a tremendous job in generating and collecting data. It is interesting on one hand to note, though, that the trying to, in fact, get information on occupational injuries and needle sticks related to HIV and AIDS is a little bit more difficult to come by. The CDC does come out with periodic reports on HIV statistics. And they had, on an annual basis at least, they were presenting data related to the number of occupational exposures that resulted in seroconversion. And there was a breakdown by profession and the type of injury that was taking place. Unfortunately, I've not seen any current data on that. I think the most current may be 2000 or 2001. Of course, as we know, there's always a lag in epidemiological data related to reporting and finally getting some material into the literature. It is interesting to note on this slide that in 1999, you can see the number of needle stick or percutaneous injuries in a teaching facility versus non-teaching facility, and into 2001, you can see a decrease. I think one can certainly attribute this to the ongoing efforts of infection control practitioners and follow-up to individuals that are having needle sticks, going out there, educating staff. We're right at that point now, certainly in the United States, where new house staff are going to be coming on board. I'm doing some work with a hospital in Long Island right now, where we're discussing with them about not just waste disposal, but obviously the issues related to proper disposal of needles, needle stick injuries, and reusable sharps containers. So certainly there is a fair amount of data that's out there that indicates there's a problem. There's an issue out there. Next slide. Also, a very good website for information is the Sharps Injury Control Program. This actually comes out of the California Department of Health Services. As, again, many of you know, the history behind the safe needle device legislation really came out of California, out of the San Francisco area. And this is an excellent website that provides a lot of information on setting up programs, implementing the programs such as if you need to do an evaluation of needle stick injuries, accident report forms. There's some information on different types of products that are out there. So certainly there's not a lack of information on the Internet in the United States. Next slide. Now, I've mentioned again the U.S. Department of Labor Occupational Safety and Health Administration. The website, as you see, is in your handout or on the screen in front of you. Again, they are the ones who provided the Bloodborne Pathogen Standard 29 Code of Federal Regulations, CFR 1910-1030. We know that there are other groups in other parts of the world, such as in England, you have the Health and Safety Executive. I'm drawing a blank right now related to the Worker Health and Safety Organization regulations within Canada, but there are comparable groups such as this actually throughout the world, and many of them have looked at what has been provided by the Bloodborne Pathogen Standard. We obviously know that the OSHA does encompass many other issues beyond the Bloodborne Pathogen Standard as well. So it is a valuable website as well. You can get a lot of information related to questions that may be related to a specific standard. Example, there's some recent recent discussions about phlebotomy devices, the Vacutainer holders only being used once and then discarded between patients. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I know at the end of my presentation we will have some time for questions. So I'd certainly love to hear what other people's thoughts are on that particular practice as well. Next slide. From an international perspective, there's two groups, the International SARPS Injury Prevention Society and the International Healthcare Worker Safety Center. The bottom one is the one that Janine Yeager has been running in Virginia. What you have as well are companies that, in fact, are manufacturing safe needle devices, have formed a coalition. As a matter of fact, it's supported not just by the companies, but you've got other organizations, I believe APIC, the American Hospital Association, and some other professional groups are also working with this coalition to get the message out to different types of individuals related to the types of products, developed the legislation to try to keep these people informed of what is the current legislation. Next slide. And here we have in the UK, working from the bottom of the slide up, in fact, Unison has been very active in promoting the use of safe needle devices. My understanding at this point right now is there is no specific legislation that these items must be used. However, they are certainly being introduced into Europe and into the Pacific Rim and other parts of the world. I think that you will find, and you may already know, that is really the distinguishing characteristic between the activity that's taking place in the United States and that of the rest of the world. In fact, there is legislation that states you must be evaluating these products. I think that's important to understand is you don't have to be using them, but if you're not, you need to definitely document why, in fact, you aren't, that you have evaluated products. I would tell you that a very interesting group that's impacted by this are dentists, because, in fact, there are very few safe needle devices for dentists. I actually provide the infection control and OSHA compliance service for a small dental group, and we've just not been successful in finding an appropriate safe needle device. So, again, the wealth of information out there on the Internet in various parts of the world. Next slide. All right, let's move into the discussion of what is a safe needle device. A safe needle device incorporates an engineering control. Remember, this is going to be engineering control terminology that comes from OSHA. It's going to be some sort of manufactured item, and in this case, it will prevent needle sticks before, during, or after use through a built-in safety feature. Next slide. Efficacy of safer needle devices. Can safer needle devices prevent needle stick injuries? Definitely, the data is out there. The Ippolito study from 1997, this is an Italian group, definitely showed that all needle sticks are not preventable, but that 83% of those from hollow bore needles can be prevented by using devices that have safety features that eliminate the use of either safety features on the needles or something that eliminates the needle altogether. Again, many of you know that there are needleless IV connectors out there. We'll talk about the self-sheathing, resheathing needles, blunted surgical needles. So there definitely can be a reduction if you're going to be using these devices. Next slide. Excuse me. And what are the types of features that are used in these devices? Well, the types can be used in a safe needle device, they're going to be categorized according to the types of features that are there. Are they active? Are they passive? Lindo Chiarello, who actually used to be at the New York State Department of Health and is now, I believe, at the Center for Disease Control, I know, had done a tremendous amount of research in this area. Now, excuse me. I'm just going to take a little sip of tea here. Excuse me for a sec. Excuse me. Next slide. If we move into discussion of passive versus active, passive features remain in effect before, during, and after use. So really, essentially, there's not much manipulation that has to be done on the part of the individual that's using the device. So in this case, this could be some of the spring-loaded lancets. As again, some of you remembered years ago, and you'll still see these now. You have metal lancets. I mean, my kids, I've got twins, 14 years old, they cringe at the sight of getting a finger stick. The last time they had to go in and have some blood work done, and they were having a finger stick done, they were using, in fact, a safe needle device, a safe needle lancet. So you have a spring-loaded device, lancet comes out, sticks the patient, goes immediately back into a protected environment. So protects the health worker, and it can be then disposed of properly. Those are passive. That's an example of a passive device. Next slide. Now, here we have Preventis. This is a BD product. You can see on the left side, it isn't activated. Before activation, the plunger has already been depressed. The material has been, whatever, injected into the patient. There's a small action, I believe, on the part of the syringe. I've, in fact, not held this syringe. I've got other ones. I have samples in front of me. Unfortunately, you just have to use your imagination. I use it from the pictures that I have here. But once it's activated, if you notice on the right side, there's a spring that activates a sheath that goes over the needle itself. So here we have an example of I would actually call this a semi-passive device because I believe it still needs some sort of activation, but it may be minimal. Again, I've not played with this particular device, but I have had other ones that work somewhat similar, and there would be a small device, a small button that one might push to, in fact, activate this. Next slide. Now, active devices, in fact, require the healthcare worker to activate a mechanism. And if you don't, then you, in fact, may still have a dangerous project. It may be, in fact, more dangerous. One of the things that I was mentioning to Paul before, that the issue, and I don't present any specific numbers related to the cost of these syringes, because, in fact, it will vary, but it is a very significant component when looking at safe needle devices. My information has told me that these can be anywhere from 2 to 10 times as expensive as a standard syringe. Yet, when we do look at some information and data related to the cost-benefit, there are some individuals that say, yeah, it's definitely beneficial to spend that extra money to avoid the cost associated with needle sticks. But what you may have, in fact, sometimes with some of these safe needle devices is in fact a more dangerous item, and certainly I think with some of these active devices, you may have a more dangerous product than a safer one, in fact, when it's not properly utilized. Next slide. So here is an example. This is called MediHut. This is a sleeve that, in fact, slides over the syringe and require the healthcare provider to pull it up over the needle. What's interesting is I remember seeing these types of sleeve mechanisms as early as 1985, 86. We were seeing some from BD at the time, but again, as many of you recall, we didn't really have much in the way of legislation. The Bloodborne Pathogen Standard was still in for review and comments. So really, these were products that were out there. Some people were using them, but clearly, without any legislation driving this, I don't think you were going to see too much in the way of use of these products. Next slide. Now, an accessory device is a safety feature that is external to the device and must be carried to or temporarily or permanently affixed to the point of use. This design is also dependent on the employee compliance and, according to some researchers, is not desirable. An integrated safety device means that the feature is really built in as an integral part of the device and cannot be removed. This is really what is the preferred method. Next slide. Now, this I find, in fact, a bit interesting. Instead of the syringe, in fact, being used to cover or eliminate the hazard, this is a product that actually comes out of France. Matter of fact, I believe now it's coming out of Portugal, but this is a device that, in fact, would melt the syringe. It's a battery-operated device. In fact, there are a number of products like this in the United States. So this would, in fact, this is the example of that accessory device that would be brought to the patient's bedside or brought somewhere wherever the needles are being generated. The employee has to know how to operate this. And in this particular case here, if you look at the bottom of this device, you'll notice that there looks like a small cutout. That's where a thumb or a finger would be pressed. And as you depress that and your syringe has been put into the port that's there, there are two blades that would shear off the needle. In fact, in shearing it off, though, they electrocute the needle, and it actually becomes ash. Now, one of the things with all of these items, in fact, yes, there's a small plume of smoke. Secondly, these cannot be used in the presence of any flammable gases. If you were to look at the 510K, the FDA, the U.S. FDA, Food and Drug Administration, pre-market approval of these products and the instructions for use, it clearly tells you that not to be used in the presence of any flammable gases. Why? Because they have the potential to release some sparks. However, this could be very useful in a low-income country where, in fact, you may be doing immunizations literally in the bush, in the jungle, in the field, and you have no method of disposal of needles other than possibly in a tin can and then being buried. So this has applications, but one has to understand what are the limitations of this product as well. Next slide. Now, here is another example of an active device. I don't recall the product name for this one, but again, small insulin syringe. You can slide the cap up, and the device now is ready for disposal. I might add that when these, in my opinion, when these things are activated, that they should still be disposed of into Sharps containers, Sharps bins. Reason being is some of these things are not always foolproof in that you may have some sort of jostling or juggling, and for whatever reason, that cap that's covering the needle may in fact slide down, and if it were inadvertently discarded into a red bag or a yellow bag, whatever the color du jour is for medical waste in a particular country, then you may still have a hazard there for the domestic, the housekeepers, the folks in environmental services. Next slide. Now, this is actually an interesting product that I have seen several variations of. This actually comes, I believe, from Taiwan. Once the injection has been completed and the plunger is depressed all the way, there's some form of locking mechanism in which the plunger locks into the hub. In the middle picture, it actually draws down the hub, that is, the needle, into the body of the syringe. You will then pull out the plunger, and it stops. You then break off the plunger, and what remains is the needle within that portion of the syringe. So, as I've stated, there's a number of these products that are out there. I've seen some of them in use, in fact, in China, and there are some companies that are trying to promote this syringe here in the United States right now as well. Interesting concept. Again, it does require education on the part of staff. There's actually one company, and I'm drawing a blank on the name right now, but if it comes to me, they actually have been able to, I think, receive some correspondence from OSHA that says, in fact, when they activate the device, it is, in fact, a sharps container. It doesn't mean it goes in the regular trash. It still will go out as medical waste, but it is disposed of into a red bag. And so that's an interesting perspective, interesting angle that they've taken there. Next slide. Now, of course, we're not just limited to safety syringes or needles. Here we have a safety IV set. Again, we're going to get into a discussion of how do you evaluate, what do you look at some of these items in a few slides here. But this is an example of where one injects, takes the needle, puts it into the safety barrel, and that eventually becomes the mechanism for infusion of the product. Again, none of these products that I've shown am I endorsing. I think they all have their positive and negative aspects to them. These are just examples to point out what's out there. We could certainly spend, hours. My understanding, there's probably over 400 products available in the United States, all different types of syringes, needleless IV sets, and what have you. So these are just examples here, folks. Next slide. This is the BD Eclipse. Again, this is another active device. Once the syringe, you've infused what needs to be infused, you then push, you'll see that little flap that will go over the cover of the syringe. Doesn't knock my socks off, but it's certainly being used out there. Again, I am not as active in, I don't draw blood anymore, I'm not giving injections. So my experience now is just playing with these on my desk and trying to figure out what are the pros and cons. So really getting feedback from your people in the field, your end users, I think is very critical here. Next slide. Obviously, one way to avoid some of these issues with respect to the needles is actually getting into needle-free devices. And again, I remember seeing some of these devices as early as the mid-80s. We had a product called ClickLock. And there was a needle that was surrounded by a plastic covering. So one could not get access to that needle, but the needle, in fact, was the male end, and it had access into a female end, and it secured itself, and when it secured itself, it clicked. So this was semi-needleless, for lack of a better term, because, in fact, there was still a needle there, but it was pretty well protected. In this case, as you can see on the left side, you have different types of devices that can be adopted to the Clave product there, in fact. So a lot of products are out there that have totally removed the potential for getting a needle stick. Obviously, we've got other issues here of looking at infection control, possible source of infection or transmission, contamination from some of these sites. So there are constant trade-offs, and so we're not totally eliminating an infection in this case, but we're obviously reducing the potential for occupational exposure to the healthcare worker. Next slide. This is actually an interesting product. Is used widely by the World Health Organization. To me, I do have a major concern with this. The focus of the Univec product was to ensure that needles were only used once. So this is a 0.5 ml syringe needle. You'll draw up your medication. Once it's infused, the syringe or the bore of the plunger, excuse me. The plunger, in fact, locks in to the body of the syringe, so you cannot pull it back out. The issue, though, that you have is you still have a needle there, so there is still a need for a disposal mechanism. And again, many of us often don't have to worry, certainly in high-income countries, of disposal of these syringes. Needles, sharps containers are readily available, but in countries where sharps containers are not available, this is still going to be an issue. So finding a product like this and trying to enhance it and possibly going that route of the Nomo stick that you saw before, I think that's an interesting concept that worth promoting, because now you have removed the potential for someone to reuse a syringe, plus you've also ensured that that needle, to a certain degree, is not likely going to cause a problem. So, again, matter of fact, some of this feedback comes from some of the users, some of the people we've met and worked with in the Caribbean the past several years. Next slide. Now, there again, I mentioned other types of websites that are available. This is actually a very good one from Unison. This is the UK group. Also, the TDIC group. This is out of California. So you've got information on, forms and things that you can, in fact, download that will help you in reviewing and evaluating the various types of safe needle devices that are available on the market. Again, for those in the United States, some of this information you are probably already aware of. Maybe in some cases you may even have some things that are more current than what I have here. We've certainly seen a lot of info that's come out over the past couple of years. So by all means, I suggest sharing it with your colleagues if you do come across anything that's new and interesting. Next slide. Okay. Things to keep in mind with these devices during use. Safety feature can be activated using a one-handed technique. Number two, safety features do not obstruct the vision of the tip of the sharp. Number three, use of this product requires you to use the safety feature. Number four, the product does not require more time to use than a non-safety device. Now, the obvious reason here, does it become more of a hazard than using just a standard syringe? Safety feature works well with a wide variety of hand sizes. Again, this is why I made the point earlier that you need to share these products with your people in the field and talk to different size individuals. I know that's always been an issue with placement of sharps containers. It's not something that you just give to an individual in engineering and say, go out there and put them at a certain height, although there is some guidance that is out there on that from NIOSH. There is some recommendations, but clearly years ago, some of these things were put out with not much consideration given to physical characteristics of the employees. The device is easy to handle while wearing gloves. Again, personal experience, I remember in the 1980s when we started to wear gloves for drawing blood, and it was extremely cumbersome. I remember my index finger always getting caught in the tourniquet. And I think, obviously, today as people learn to draw blood, to give injections, what you end up doing is, in fact, learning the technique. This is how you started, so it's much easier versus those of us that have been doing it or had been doing it for a long time and making that change. Number seven, the device does not interfere with the use that do not require a needle. Number eight, the device offers a good view of any aspirated fluid. I think certainly in the 80s and the early 90s when these products were first out there, those were some of the challenges that we faced because, again, a lot of these particular questions and issues hadn't been quite thought through at that time. Device will work with all required syringe and needle sizes. Next page. Next slide. After use, there is a clear and unmistakable change, an audible or visible, that occurs when the safety feature is activated. As I had pointed out to you, the click lock, we were all fascinated with that. In fact, we had done a study, it was very well received, and actually until just about a year ago, I, I still had some of those samples on my desk in my office because it was one of the first items that I had seen. The safety feature operates reliably. Number 12, the exposed sharp is permanently blunted or covered after use and prior to disposal. Actually, I find one of the interesting phlebotomy needles that's out there is a company called BioPlexus. I've got some familiarity with BioPlexus, having one, they are a Connecticut company, and it was about 10 years ago when they were first just developing the products that I had an opportunity to visit their facility just to look at some OSHA compliance issues. And in this particular case, there is a bore within the bore of the needle, but it's blunted, or device, a metal pipe, essentially extremely small, but within the needle itself, and it is activated at the end of the phlebotomy for procedure so that you don't have a bevel anymore. Excuse me. Interesting product. And last, this device is no more difficult to process after use than non-safety devices. Next slide. Training. I think this is obviously, and we know from anything that we provide to our colleagues or employees, this is a very critical part here. User does not need extensive training for correct operation. Number 15, the design of the device suggests proper use. And if it does take a long time to figure out how this thing works, you may have an issue there. It is not easy to skip a crucial step in the proper use of devices. And I can imagine now the challenge that individuals face, hospitals, when you start looking at the number of devices that are out there. And so obviously I think, one, discussing things amongst your colleagues in your local area. I know recently APIC has had their national meeting. You may have had an opportunity to see some of the products that are out there. I think clearly, obviously reviewing the literature is good. And also your personal experience is going to help in evaluating some of these products. So you have the above questions. Which three are the most important to your safety when using this product? Again, some of these questions, some of these items actually come off of some of the websites that I've mentioned. You know, are there other questions that you feel should be asked regarding the safety and utility of this product? One of the things to keep in mind is the uniqueness of your facility. I mean, I always think of hospitals as a human being. It has a life of its own. It's got a personality of its own. And what may necessarily work in one facility doesn't necessarily work in another one. So I think that's an important thing to understand is what is the personality within your facility, of your staff, of your employees, of your administration. I think also, next slide, it's important that you have follow-up. I think it's extremely critical that once you've gone out with these products that you do go back and you do sit down and you do evaluate what are staff's issues and concerns. Even after you've gone through an initial evaluation and you've purchased the product, I think you'd still need to go back and discuss these items with individuals. I make references as a report in the literature because there's some several interesting points here. This is a report on the Council on Scientific Affairs, Preventing Needle Stick Injuries in Healthcare Settings, the Archives of Internal Medicine from 2001. Staff involvement in evaluation and selection of safer devices and the proper education and training of staff in their use was an extremely effective means of preventing percutaneous injury. I think this is this should be obvious to people. It's very important to get their buy-in, and I think it's very important to get buy-in when you start looking at different units, whether it's the intensive care unit, the operating theater, the OR, emergency room, accident, and emergency. Those individuals, again, they're all different environments, so you need to discuss with them. You need to sit down and understand what their needs are. I appreciate that you may not have an incredible complementary of syringes available. You may have some limitations, but I think it's important to sit down with these staff and get people that it can actually be champions for you even on those particular wards or units. Number two is the use of safer devices was not reported to affect delivery of patient care. And third, a comprehensive safety and health program may be the most effective way to reduce the risk of bloodborne pathogen transmission. Again, it's interesting, back in the early 80s, Safety committees were not extremely prevalent in hospitals, or if they were prevalent, the amount of activity and discussions that were taking place, I would say, appeared to be limited. I think there's been a very much of a tremendous amount of growth in the area of health and safety. There are many, many more issues that we are in tune with, even within the Joint Commission under the Environments of Care. Much bigger push looking at things related to hazardous waste, mercury, obviously, you know, the bloodborne pathogen. We've been dealing with this for over a decade, so we're pretty much well ingrained within our minds now at this point, but there's still room for improvement. It is a dynamic process. So you can see, again, those of you that have been in healthcare for 20 years, we've seen quite a interesting evolution and a tremendous improvements, but there's still room for improvements in a lot of areas as well. Next slide. Additionally, increased cost and staff resistance to change were the two most frequent obstacles to adopting safety needles. As I mentioned before, I really did not cover anything related to the cost of these today, although I think that obviously has to be a critical factor that comes into play. Regardless of the product that you're looking at, hospitals are a business. Yes, you are taking care of patients, but it is also a business. So one has to look at the financial implications here as well. And staff resistance to change, tell me something that I don't already know. I deal with a lot of things related to medical waste management. I just had an issue within a labor and delivery department where there was a bit of a revolt, and primarily the revolt was because they were asked to separate waste, that is, infectious waste from non-infectious waste. And unfortunately, the Environmental Services Department went up, made a change without even any discussion with staff. Believe it or not, they provided considerably smaller red containers, this is what would be used in the U.S., to collect medical waste. Well, what was happening is half of the infectious material was going into the solid waste stream. Even placentas now were being discarded as solid waste. So you need to get buy-in from staff, and that is a challenge. There's no denying it. It is a challenge. Excuse me. The next item, safer devices are generally more expensive than conventional devices, but the additional cost for a facility is a small fraction of the total cost. I would suggest trying to find this article and actually look at what kind of numbers that they were actually presenting there. You've got to look at your own facility. What are the costs that are associated there? Obviously, depending on what part of the part of the U.S. you're in and what type of purchasing power you have, this is going to impact what devices you're going to be looking at. And lastly, reductions in needle stick incidents will result in substantial financial benefits from reduced post-exposure testing and treatment, as well as health benefits from reduced transmissions of disease. And I think, you know, this is what we've been hearing all along, but when you have to look at it within your own facility, you've got to do the numbers, you've got to crunch the data and see, in fact, what is really happening there. Next slide. So my final comments are, you know, many products exist in the marketplace. I think you need to do your research and determine what works best for you and your institution. Safety devices are, as from the study we just mentioned, are generally more expensive than conventional devices, but the total additional cost for a facility is a small fraction of the total cost. And with that, thank you very much. Paul, back to you.
Thank you very much, Ed. That was a fantastic presentation. I'm very pleased with the information you brought to us. Ed, I noticed that your contact information is on the second slide of your PowerPoint.
Yes.
So I presume that it would be all right for people to contact you directly if they have questions?
Certainly, yes. Actually, email is the best because wherever I am, I do travel a lot. I go through spurts of where I'm outside of the U.S., so the email is the best way to get a hold of me. I'll find access to the Internet one way or another. So send me your questions, whatever, and I know I don't have all the answers, but I have a lot of contacts within various agencies, whether it be domestically or internationally, and I'm happy to forward your question or comments to other individuals and make an introduction for you and see if there's a way to help you.
Thank you all for joining us on this teleclass. today. And again, Ed, thank you for an excellent presentation.